Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today's Thursday, July 19th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the second quarter wrap-up. The wrap-ups are a time when I like to look back and look forward. It's very important to me on the Solari Report that we help you stay focused on the primary trends. It's staying focused on the primary trends is essential for taking action and not being distracted by the noise. There's plenty of noise, a lot of it very misleading, and I want to, with the wrap-ups, keep bringing you back to seeing the what's really going on and what's really important. Our discussion is going to organize tonight around the top trends that were listed in the annual wrap-up I did in January, and our poster this year, there's a poster on each annual wrap-up, and we make an effort in the annual wrap-ups to do a lot of special graphics and some useful appendices, so I'd really encourage you, if you haven't looked at it, to go back and look at the transcript for this year, if not all the annual wrap-ups. This year, the poster said, it's got a young child with a little with a little sign that says, the beginning is near, and that's sort of a play on words of all the people saying the end is near. I think 2012 is going to have a lot more beginnings than endings. But it's clearly going to be, and it's clearly wrapping up to be a very busy year. I was going to do money and markets before, but this week's stories fit in so nicely with the long-term trends, I thought we would just dive in. And then as part of the wrap-up, I wanted to introduce my approach to the equity markets, because we're going to be doing increased coverage of the financial markets, particularly the equity markets, on the Solari Report. So I just wanted to give you a frame of what I want to focus on and why. Our theme tonight is the bailout turns to buyout. The bailout turns to buyout. I'm going to keep saying it because I want you to remember this expression, the bailout turns to buyout. We just gave a group of people $26 trillion, and now they're going to use that money to come and buy out the people who gave it to them. It's going to be a fairly invisible process, but it's because of the extent of the movement, it's going to be very important to see it and be able to not get run over by it, if anything, to take advantage of it. This is what a financial coup d'etat is. It's a leveraged buyout of the ownership and control of a country. The outlines of the buyout are emerging. Let me go back to 1989 when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing. We saw the pump and dump of the housing market in the 80s with the S&L crisis and a huge run-up of credit into real estate. Then the plug was pulled in the mid to late 80s. They pulled the tax credits in 86. And the federal credit, it really got pulled at the beginning of the new administration, the Bush administration. We had massive defaults. The Resolution Trust Corporation did about a $500 billion buy and sell of defaulted mortgages and assets and institutions. And I'll never forget sitting in the Treasury room at the Department of the Treasury with this long table, I think we were in the cash room, and the Secretary of Treasury, Alan Greenspan, the Fed chairman, was there, and there was a debate going on about whether the federal government was going to provide financing on the auctions. And I realized, I'll never forget it, a chill went down my back. And what I realized was that the people who had gotten out at the top of the housing pump were coming back and buying things at 10 cents on the dollar. And I realized the magnitude of how bad the fraud was and how much money they were going to make on it. And I really expected, when the plug was pulled on the mortgage market in 2006, I thought, well, is the money going to start rolling in and buying up the mortgages? And it was slowly that it dawned on me as the bailouts proceeded that this time we're looking at something that's much more strategic, much more ambitious. If you've read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, I think it's very good background to help understand what's going to happen. This time we saw the Fed and Treasury keep the paper in much tighter hands, not do a bad bank, not let it be auctioned off. That's going to permit a much more controlled turn, not only to clean up the fraud, but the money doesn't have to compete in the way that it did in 1989. It makes re-engineering places and aggressively buying up rural land, including raising housing stock and farmland, much easier to do on a quiet basis. And to be blunt, if you haven't listened to our series on chemtrails, I would encourage you to do it, because thanks to HAARP and chemtrails, financial reengineering can now be combined with weather warfare to consolidate ownership and control of places in a way that no one even dreamed of in the early 90s. So this time we're not just talking about making 10 times on your money and flipping real estate, or the ability of local corporations to move in on the local guys just because they pulled the bank credit and the big corporations have access to financial markets globally, including the equity markets. This time we're talking about strategic control of industries, the integration of both dazzling and terrifying new technology. I don't need to remind you that they're looking to roll out drones all across America in the coming years, and the fundamental reengineering of places, not just who's in the leadership positions, but we're talking about changes of laws, changes in governance structure, abrogation of contracts, and even elimination of populations. Now, don't let that phrase shock you. That's what essentially the drug business and the war on drug business has been for 50 years. It's been going on for a long time. But we're entering the next phase of the coup d'etat, and it's rolling out right in front of us in a very quiet and invisible way, but again, because of the extent of the money, very, very powerful. So the bailout is mostly over, not completely over. Their workout's still going on. The buyout has barely begun, and the buyout's going to be a very big shift of money. As the capital flows back on shore, it means that America's going to have a renaissance for the insiders and the people helping them, and a lot of outsiders are going to get rolled by the money stolen from them, ultimately paying for the bailouts many times over. Now, when I talked in the annual wrap-up, I identified six key trends for 2012, and they were the demographics imperative, transformations and awakenings, planet Earth, science and technology, the half-pregnant empire, and then finally financial coup d'etat and slow burn. So I'm going to go through each one of them in the context of what's happened in the first half of the year and looking forward into the next half. The demographics imperative. One of the things I do once a year is I get the new almanac and I sit down and I skim it cover to cover. And it's one way to really understand the power of demographics and what the growing population means globally. We're not growing more land, we're just growing more people. We have an aging population in Europe and North America. North America's been offsetting that with immigration and probably will continue to. Europe's struggling, and certainly Japan is struggling with aging population. Someone just sent me an article this week about how disadvantaged the new generation is, the millennials, and it's true that our kids and grandkids are facing a much meaner road than my generation did. It's very important. The article they sent was by was in a fairly large public, I think it was in Newsweek, but it very much positioned the millennials to blame the baby boomers for their ills. Don't fall into that trap. It's another version of the divide and conquer of turning men against women, whites against black, Americans against immigrants, generations against each other. It's just another trap, and if you look, really dig deep and you understand what's causing the problems, what you'll understand is that getting sucked into the divide and conquer is going to make things worse for everybody, but certainly for you. I know it's always upsetting to me when I watch the Occupy movement, lots of good and well-intended people framing things into the 99% versus the 1%, and what I know is often the 1% is not very wealthy people. The way the 1% is being positioned, it's their parents or grandparents who've worked hard and saved, and in fact, they're teeing up the political spin to make it possible to tax their parents or grandparents in a manner that will dilute their inheritance or family wealth. So it's very important not to get caught up in these simple divide-and-conquer frames, because we end up shooting the wrong guy. I believe the greatest thing we need right now is power, individually and collectively, and the way you get that power is you take responsibility. You don't fall into the trap of blaming others. I'm not saying that the bailouts and the buyout are your individual fault or my individual fault, but I take full responsibility because that's where I can get my power. and when I take responsibility for my well-being and success in the environment, no matter what's going on, as well as being of service to others, that's when I start to move forward and get something accomplished. And there's going to be a lot of divide and conquer building. The other thing is, I think it's very important, what I've found is it's very different globally, place by place, what the changes in population and the growth in population mean to you. Very different dynamics, particularly given what resources you have around and whether you're positioned to be taking advantage of the way things are going or not. So, but I would really encourage you to assess the changes, what changes in population mean to the place where you are, and look at what that means to you over the long run. One of my favorite quotes is from the hockey player Wayne Gretzky. He said, "I skate to where the puck will be." And it's very important when you think about skating to where the puck will be, you think about what population means to your work, your location, every aspect of your life. That's it for demographics. Let's turn to transformations and awakenings. We certainly heard a great deal about shift in consciousness in 2012 and the power and importance of it. On the positive note, what I've seen is that the walls of the matrix are shifting out. Conversations that often were considered socially unacceptable 5 or 6 years ago are very easy to have now, and I think they're one of the positives of the internet is we're learning more and more about what's going on, and we can start to deal with the complexity of many different worlds, including worlds that we know nothing about. And that's giving most people a lot more intelligence about what's really going on if they want it. I'm not seeing signs of a higher consciousness. So on a less than positive note, everything I've seen so far, both here and even in Europe, is, if anything, the rate of entropy is increasing. You see heavy entrainment and mind control, a lot of anger and frustration at the acceleration of the changes, and the slowness in many parts of the economy, the fall of income, the debasement coming from the degradation of the currency. And I think one message that I got from the first half of the year is it's extremely important to be in it but not of it. If the fields around you are deteriorating, you need to practice how not to be of it and stay in a higher consciousness. I still think I'm seeing many people make the mistake of assuming that the collapse of my world or my industry or my income means the collapse of the system. The system survives by composting people and harvesting our assets, and we need to understand and be able to differentiate between the collapse of a certain segment and the collapse of the whole system. I'm always amazed at how many people are sure the system is going to collapse tomorrow, you know, and that it's been that way for 20 years. Franklin Sanders and I are having a conference in Tennessee in October called Transformation and Renewals, and one of the topics, there are 4 discussion groups, one on faith, one on people, one on money, and one on health, and a lot of the discussion in the people section really focuses on how do we stay in a higher consciousness when those around us are sliding into the pea soup, and how do we stay joyful doing it? Because I find that is more and more on the mind of my clients and subscribers these days. That's it for awakenings. Planet Earth. I think the most important story in the United States in the first half of the year was the seriousness of the drought. The seriousness of the drought is very significant. To give you an example, Michigan is reporting that they anticipate losing 80% of their apple crop. Report out this morning, 40% of the corn crop may be lost based on just more drought for the last 2 weeks. Earlier this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture declared natural disaster areas in 1,300 counties in 29 states because of drought conditions. Drought is what forces small farmers and ranchers to sell. I got one email message from a subscriber down in Texas who said that one of the government employees in the ag area had told him that Texas ranchers were going to have to sell or slaughter 600,000 head of cattle. That's a very significant sell. What that means is that bailout money can come back in and buy cheap. The United States is positioning itself for the next 50 years to be a very significant force in agricultural exports, and so consolidation of farmland is a very important strategic position. I also expect that the declaring natural disasters, as I said this before and set it up on the blog, gives feds the ability to continue a covert QE. When you have different kinds of disasters, all of the different mortgage operations in the federal government, VA, Farmers Home, FHA, can sort of open the spigot and buy up a lot of mortgage paper, and so you can clean up a tremendous amount of mortgage fraud inside of a disaster and skim tremendous monies both out of the federal budget but also out of the premiums collected in the various mortgage funds. So I'll bet you dimes to donuts there's a lot going on there. And again, that gives a variety of different parties the ability to aggregate and create big positions in land, really on the taxpayer's dime. What's your action? I can't begin to stress enough how important it is to make sure you line up sources of fresh food. You know where your food's going to come from. The price of food is going to continue to go up. You need to make decisions about if you need to buy feed for animals. It may make sense to stock up now. But again, the question is, over the years, as this consolidation of farmland and the food supply goes on, there are going to be real questions about what you can buy at the grocery store, not just what price, but what quality. And again, quality farmland with good water is going to continue to be a very good investment. Next topic, science and technology. Many things have happened this year that have given me the opportunity to look at the new technology that is sort of in the process of being applied. It's being applied in the laboratory, or it's being, it's working towards a variety of different approvals. It's working to get patents. It's working to, you know, create companies. It's being marketed. One of those opportunities was the movie Thrive, which came out at the end of last year and really goes into the topic of free energy. And I had the opportunity to see the producers of Thrive about 6 weeks ago and spend some time with them. And it was very interesting because what's happened as a result of Thrive is just an explosion of a flow of information about new technology, new energy technology to the people involved. And things seem to really be growing and developing. And so I had a chance to really sit down with Foster and Kimberly Gamble and listen to sort of what they're seeing and hearing that's going on around the world in that area. And then you'll see if you go to the events section on the Solari site, I'm going to be speaking in Holland in November at a conference called Breakthrough Energy Movement. It's a group of young Dutch people who've gotten together and are putting together a conference, and I hope it will be live through the Internet as well, that brings together leaders in energy, new energy technology from around the world. And they're hoping to do it, as one of the sponsors said, in a way that makes it accessible to cab drivers, which is exactly the way this needs to happen. And I'm not going to be speaking, obviously, on energy. I'm going to be speaking on the financial models that you need to finance this kind of energy and the implications for the financial system and economy. But it's, to me, it's something that's very exciting. And again, it's another example that this conversation is just happening. Then I sit every week for literally, you know, several hours a day working in the investment committee at C-Lane Advisory, which is my money management company. And what we've seen again and again in the markets in the last 6 months is the area in the market that is performing well is in new technology. And it's new technology in many, many different areas, you know, everything from dentistry to to information technology, but it's quite amazing the extent of the venture capital and entrepreneurship that's going on, and we're going to see that eventually come out into the equity markets. And I've been trying on the blog to cover that, including a lot of, if you go through the blog, you'll see a lot on the what's been happening in research and development. So what happened with this with the particle accelerator in CERN, and I try and cover everything from new weapons, not something that makes you happy necessarily, to sort of the things that we wish weren't happening. Dr. McCullough, for example, had an article this week on how human babies are already being genetically engineered so that the child has the genes of three parents. Anyway, but the thing to see about technology is that there's a real double-edged sword. There's enormous increases in productivity, but there's also terrible invasiveness of privacy, and not all the technology is good for human health and living health. So there are things that are both dazzling and wonderful and things that are terrifying. But if I have one message on the issue of science or technology, it's here it comes, ready or not. And I'd like to give you an example, and it's something that I'm spending a surprising amount of time looking into, and I'll just call this little section, What's Up in Detroit? There's a pattern of something happens. Things happen. A lot of what I do in terms of understanding what's going on in the economy, I would describe as pattern recognition. I look for patterns of different unusual things, strange things, and I just collect the patterns and the sort of events, and sure enough, a bigger movement of money starts to emerge. And I've been watching this around the audio industry, trying to figure out what's going on, and I've reached the point where there's a pattern that I'm testing that I can share with you. This all started when I watched the takeover of General Motors during the bailouts. The fierceness of the battle and the people who took it over and the way they exercised early control said to me something was unusual here, something was up, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And then it was accompanied by real fierceness on the part of the Department of Justice, attacking Toyota, doing everything it could to ensure that General Motors was able to finally, as it did early this year, make it to number one globally. At the same time that was happening, the General Motors hometown, Detroit, was going through arguably the worst pump and dump and gentrification of any place in the U.S. mortgage portfolio, with the possible exception of San Bernardino, which PS announced it was filing for bankruptcy recently. But Detroit was particularly ugly, including aggressive raising of land because the defaults and sort of municipality takeover of the properties became so extensive. And then about 2 weeks ago, retired Judge Stanley Sporkin, former general counsel of the CIA, whose record is so amazing, I even have a hot seat. If you do a search for Stanley Sporkin, you'll see the hot seat I wrote on his really distinguished career. So Stanley Sporkin is on the radio talking about enterprise zones, and I said, oh, dear, these guys are ready to re-engineer places. What's up? Well, then the U.S. Commerce announces, as I've discussed in the last couple of weeks, that it's going to open regional patent offices in Dallas. That makes sense. Denver, that makes sense. Silicon Valley, that makes sense. And Detroit. I said, Detroit? What's Detroit? Something's up in Detroit. Well, this week, the rating agencies threatened to lower Wayne County's ratings. That's the county that Detroit's in. Control of the bonds in a default could give a syndicate a lot of power, especially the state in 2011, the state of Michigan, created emergency powers. So if the right players had control of those different positions, that gives you the ability to get an awful lot done. Okay, well, finally, this Friday, out comes Kiplinger's newsletter. Let me just read it to you. As automotive technology races ahead, the impact through the economy The impact will ripple through the economy. Advances will build on steps already taken. Onboard electronic sensors enabling cars on the road now to parallel park, jam on the brakes if traffic suddenly halts, and warn of lane strain. Within a few years, such features will be widespread and will perform increasingly sophisticated functions, monitoring driver alertness, routing trips, and more. Then a critical communications leap, onboard wireless transmitters that allow vehicles to relay their speed and locations to one another. By 2020, all new cars will have the technology. Odds are that Uncle Sam will require at least some of it as a safety measure, much as seatbelts are now. Self-driving autos won't be far behind, taking full advantage of car-to-car communications and electronic controls. Drivers will still be able to pilot themselves, but most folks will trust the car. That will travel trim times for road warriors of all sorts, commuter truckers, delivery drivers, etc. Employers will benefit too. Heavy traffic waste countless man hours in LA, for example, 56 per worker a year. The combination of autonomous cars and wireless traffic management systems will route traffic more efficiently through congested urban areas and bottlenecks. As a result, better fuel efficiency and less need to widen many roads. Dramatic safety increases too, slashing the number of crashes and fatalities by up to 75%. So lower auto insurance premiums and fewer auto body crashes, fewer body repairs. Fewer crashes also mean less need for heavy steel bodies to withstand accidents. Plus, good news for older drivers, safety overrides many, may keep them on the road longer. For marketeers, a whole new arena for highly customized advertising. As cars plug into the internet for traffic routing, they'll signal where they're headed, triggering in-car ads. Headed past a donut shop, you may get a coupon for it. Such smart cars could also be the key to winning back younger buyers. It goes on and on and on. Of course, there will be downsides and obstacles to negotiate, like privacy concerns are inevitable. I can imagine there was a time during my litigation with the federal government that a group of people, two people working in concert, tried to run me off the road. I can just imagine if they had the power to hack into my car and just literally get my car to drive off the road. So, yes, privacy concerns are a very big issue. Now, let's get back to Detroit. We now see a city where we have a sort of culturally hip downtown surrounded by rings of just raised land. I believe Detroit is not falling apart. Detroit is being reassembled for a new area. One of the things I'm doing is I'm keeping an eye on real estate in Detroit. I'm asking people to look into it for me because I think Detroit and other areas are going to be targeted to be centers for the new smart manufacturing and tech. And strategically placed real estate and farmland are going to be great investments if purchased in the early phase of the buyout. I just think it's part of, again, from bailouts to buyouts. Okay, next section, half-pregnant empire. The description, the term half-pregnant empire, was made to describe sort of the process that the American government and military has been in since 2011, which is significantly moving our military, both military bases and special forces, around the world, creating with a global navy, if you will, and global satellites, a global empire. Earlier this year, we had one of the Joint Chiefs testify about the fact that we have special forces now in over 100 countries, and there are significant operations going on around the world that we don't see in the paper. I think drones are going to be a very important part of this. They sort of, they sort of do operationally a lot of things that is more expensive or harder for the satellites to do. Clearly, the beatdown in Syria is on, and I'm still expecting us to go into Syria this year. I said at the beginning of the year that I thought there was an 85% chance that we would attack Iran this year. I am changing that. I think that's going to be something that happens in 2013 or 2014. They're going to try and keep getting sanctions to work. Although we saw Russia and it was Russia and one other country resisting today in the UN Security Council. But but they're going to keep trying to use sort of nonviolent sort of efforts on Iran. But that's all part of getting the empire building out. Next year is a big year in terms of reengineering the federal budget. It's being sort of postured as a fiscal crisis to come right now. A lot of talk about defense cuts. I doubt that those defense cuts, if they come, will interfere with the plans. And some of those, at least some of the conversation about defense cuts, is really to protect the defense budget from the real cuts, which are coming across the board in labor, in retirement benefits, in health care, in a variety of different income areas, except special ones sort of designed to help with the corporate future. But they need to make it look like the cuts are coming across the board, but I'd be very surprised if the cuts in any way impaired the plans for empire, because if you look at the winnings of empire, particularly in the natural resource area, if you look at the resources that are coming back from building the empire globally, they're very significant, both in the form of running the reserve currency and accessing natural resources and controlling access to markets in a very economic way. And the expenses are running through the federal budget, but many of the revenues are not, and so it doesn't look economic. But if you look at it on a very integrated basis, it really is. And so the empire will continue to build out, and as of now, there seems to be nothing that's going to slow it down. One thing I would encourage you to watch, there's a video up on the blog in Geopolitics this week, and it's a very short clip of an interview Charlie Rose did with former Secretary of State Jim Baker and current Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And it's just about a three-minute clip. And in it, it shows Jim Baker talking about attacking Iran and Hillary Clinton responding in a way that literally 15 years ago would have been absolutely unthinkable. And it's a very interesting comment on the change in manner in which sort of attacking and taking over countries are being discussed. And it's really worth watching to show you the extent to which the empire is now operating and talking like an empire. So that's it for global empire. Let's turn to financial coup d'etat and slow burn, which was the last of the six categories. If you go back and look at the Sir James Goldsmith video, which I'm always trying to make sure that all of our subscribers go back and watch, what we've been watching for the last 15 years is a fundamental shift between the relationship between capital and labor. And what we're doing is we're competing labor against itself globally, and in the process shifting the value of labor against capital. And part of that is in anticipation of what technology can do. What technology can do is literally replace human labor on many, many of the functions that we are now doing. So, for example, if you take a look at what's happening with robotics and different kinds of automation, it's absolutely possible to posit that in 10 years' time, we don't need 90% of the people working in fast food restaurants. It can all be done by robots. But that really begs the question, if the provision, if my housing, if my food, if my all the things that I need to live, instead of, you know, once upon a time I did them all for myself, or communities did them all for myself, and then we went to the employment model where we went off and we earned money and then turned around and bought those things from corporations. If we're not going to have employment income, then the question is, well, how is the model supposed to work? If income isn't generated from employment, then exactly, you know, we can fantastically increase the productivity of doing all these things, but then if no one has any income to use those things, well, how's that supposed to work? And for about 15 years now, we've steadily replaced that falling income, to the extent it's been replaced, by government checks of various kinds, both that come through directly or indirectly. and we've reached a tipping point where the number of households, both in Europe and in the United States, that are dependent on government checks is growing dramatically, and it really begs the question, okay, are we going to change the model? And one of the big questions when the United States sort of hits the fiscal cliff next year that to a certain extent Europe has hit is what's going to happen, and what we're going to see is an enormous squeezing of pension and retirement benefits, tax changes that also squeeze the same people who are being squeezed, a squeezing of municipal budgets and more bankruptcies and workouts and abrogations of contracts at the municipal level, which is going to hit the same household. So imagine a family that is having their pension and retirement benefits cut at the same time somebody in the family is being laid off, at the same time that their municipality is raising rates or not providing services, at the same time that their health care in terms of quality or benefits is being cut, and on and on and on, and their taxes are being raised at the federal level. We just saw an announcement that the New Jersey governor has come out in support, along with a lot of other governors, but he's the most, I think, important ones in terms of giving it credibility, for online sales tax, for sales tax for online purchases. So, you know, this is going to be death by lots and lots of different cuts. And so we're seeing this squeeze. And if you look at the stories that are popping out and that I've been putting up on the blog, you'll see it again and again. So let me give you an example of what this looks like. American Airlines declares bankruptcy, and the goal of the bankruptcy is basically to wipe out the pension benefits and to re-engineer the contracts with labor. So it's a way of squeezing labor and pension funds. We have the CEO saying he will resign. He won't do that. You know, he thinks it's essentially an abrogation of contracts. It's unethical. And so he won't do it, and they have to appoint another guy and proceed with it. But proceed with it they did, and certainly American Airlines is not the first company to use bankruptcy to basically recut their deal with labor in a stunning way. I'm a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra. They just did the very same thing. We now see a big brouhaha in California this week. CalPERS announced that it only had a fairly low yield. Actually, in terms of performance, it wasn't bad for the year, given what's happened to yields in the marketplace. But it raises the question of if state and local government pension funds are going to have to cut back their yield targets, this means that the annual contribution coming from municipalities is going to have to be raised, and that means taxes are going to have to be raised. And, of course, this raises the question of how much money has been pulled out the back end of those pension funds on the pump and dump of the telecoms and the mortgage bubble and all the different ways that pension funds have received a lower yield as a result of the many, many things that has created the bailout kitty that's now going to come back and buy up America. And then, of course, we saw the debate about Obamacare, which after the Supreme Court decision is becoming more and more fractious. We have states saying they're not going to go along. We have people in Congress insisting they're going to try and fight it. And, of course, the polls indicate that you have a majority of Americans who resent being ordered to buy a private good as a form of tax. And the precedent itself is very, very scary. But all of these things are part of what I would call the financial coup d'etat and slow burn. And they're going to continue. We're really, because of the importance and size of the pension funds and the amount of promises that have been made, we're going into something that's a long squeeze. And for each one of you, whether you have pensions, whether you have 401ks, whether your municipality is under pressure, it's very, very important to see the different aspects of how that squeeze is going to hit your balance sheet and income statement and be prepared for it. You know, there are many things, it's an ugly picture to look at, but there are many things you can do if you look at it now and prepare for what might be. one of the things that has been in the paper and been on the blog over the last 6 months that I want to talk a little bit about, which is a very important part of the financial coup d'etat and the slow burn, is what I call the Sheriff of Nottingham phenomena. Most people remember the Sheriff of Nottingham. He was the bad guy in Robin Hood. He was the sheriff of the area and proceeded to run around and steal and kill and terrorize. But clearly the Sheriff of Nottingham was in the business of making money. During the 90s, I dealt extensively and studied extensively the Department of Justice's essentially growth in business in asset forfeiture and civil money penalties. We had gone through a process in the 80s and 90s where more and more federal agencies were given the power to make arrests, were given the power to carry guns, and were given extensive powers to do civil money penalties or to literally seize assets through the Asset Forfeiture Fund, which was created at the Department of Justice. And this whole infrastructure created literally a money-making operation where government made money by doing business with tipsters and whistleblowers and literally enforcing, not in an action to necessarily bring in to make sure that the law was upheld, but in an action literally that made them money. And it was oftentimes, you would see bizarre situations where literally it wasn't, the person who was targeted wasn't doing anything wrong, but the attitude of the enforcers was, but it'll take you $100,000 to prove that there is nothing wrong, so if you just give me $25,000, I'll go away. So you literally had a form of government blackmail. What we're watching in the LIBOR scandal is a perfect example. Barclays Bank made a settlement with the Department of Justice and another U.S. agency as well as the British agency and paid over $400 million. Now, the pressure during a period of defense cutbacks or budget cutbacks to generate the pressure on enforcement agencies to generate revenues means that they're very interested in having scandals where they can make money because that money has an influence on the appropriator's willingness to appropriate money for their operations. Certainly, everybody is familiar with what happens in municipalities when they're in budget trouble. You get more and more tickets being given, more parking tickets, more speeding tickets. I've talked on the Salieri Report about a dear friend of mine who sent me an email from a farming state and said that he had asked a raw milk dairy. Somebody had said, a couple came in very well dressed, driving a BMW, and wanted inquired about raw milk. And he said, "Oh, great, you made a sale." And he said, "Oh no, we would never sell to them. They're strangers. The state pays $2,000, per tip to people like those to turn people like us in." And it was very. And he had written me an email and said, "This is frightening." But if you look at the amount of entrepreneurial Sheriff of Nottingham kind of enforcement at the state, at the local, at the federal level, it's growing steadily. And as we go through this change and different budgets, governmental budgets, are under pressure, these kinds of actions are going to keep on growing. Now, why am I saying this to you? First of all, when you look at stories like the LIBOR scandal, anytime you see a big settlement for the Department of Justice, one of the things you need to understand is one of the reasons this may have turned into a scandal is because it's a good money-making operation for them. Not necessarily always. It's just something to keep in mind. But the second thing is I want you to understand you cannot assume that enforcement is always legitimate. You cannot assume that an enforcement operation is interested in applying the law. You have to realize that they have perverse financial incentives, and it pays to understand what their incentives are. If a town has budget problems, please do not speed through that town. And you can understand it in the context of a parking ticket or a speeding ticket, but you need to think about it in the context of all sorts of different things. I can't tell you how many people are aware that they can make tips to local law enforcement by telling somebody about something you did wrong. So just be conscious of that trend and really keep it in mind as you go through your day, because one of the things you do not want to do is you do not want to get embroiled with any kind of enforcement actions. The LIBOR scandal, I have an article up on the blog about the LIBOR scandal. This is not a scandal that I would like to see you spend a lot of time on. As I've said before, they're trying to move the banks to a utility model now that the financial coup d'etat has moved, you know, through the bailout phase, not to say it's completely over. They really don't need the banks to have the kind of capacity that they have, and they certainly don't need to pay them the kind of money they've been paying them. So if banks depend on the federal credits for bailouts and on the central banks for bailouts, then the banks need to be on much more of what's called a utility business model, where they, you know, it's kind of cost plus, they get a built-in profit, and their speculation is reined in a lot more. What you're watching in the LIBOR scandal, I suspect, and you can see this from reading my 20 questions on the LIBOR scandal, it's up on the homepage or the front of the blog, is we're really looking for the central banks to exercise much tighter control over the banks, and particularly over interest rates. They're trying very hard to keep interest rates down, and I suspect that this is part of doing it. Again, don't lose time or energy. Don't think that this is a real big reform. It's interesting to note that the scandals that tend to happen are ones that make money for the Sheriff of Nottingham. They're not scandals that remind you that money's stolen that we can get back. I'm always laughing. I was just laughing with somebody today because the cover story on Madoff was that it was a Ponzi scheme. Well, it's the perfect explanation, because in a Ponzi scheme, the money's gone. You don't want anybody to think it was a scheme where the money is still there and somebody could get it back, which, of course, I believe it is. So you need to have a great local bank, but the action on the LIBOR scandal is don't lose sleep over it. The central banks are going to do everything they can to keep the interest rates down for some period of time. I said at the beginning of the year I thought it was going to slow burn for the rest of the year. I continue to think so. The chances that that we'll have another QE3, another quantitative easing, I think are reasonably good. The one thing that could kill it, if a real decision is made to promote Romney into the presidency, because a QE3 will probably more than likely help Obama even a lot. There's been a lot of coverage to suggest that a QE3 will not be effective. It's not going to be as effective as QE1 or QE2, but the string is not run out on printing money or on the Fed's power to sort of create inflation, monetary inflation, to offset deflation. So I think there will be a QE3, and that means whatever you do, don't sell your tangibles yet, because they're probably going to be supported by the Fed for the rest of the year. So expect a slow burn. Interestingly enough, I turned on Yahoo Finance about 3 days ago, and suddenly it looked like Le Metropole Cafe in 2003. We had John Maudlin, Peter Schiff, an article about the Great Depression. It was unbelievable. Somebody's trying to persuade everybody that things are really, really bad. And it was funny because I just put that down as another indication that the bailout money is looking to come back in and buy out, because at that point the spin was too negative, despite the fact that the market wasn't down 30%. Okay, highlights for the Solari report in the first half of 2012. There were two, for me, incredible interviews in the first half that I really recommend to you. One was John Rappaport talking about his new collection, or it's a republication of his interviews called, and he called it The Matrix Revealed. I got a message from one really wonderful subscriber who said essentially, after listening to it, you know, I thought I was going to be depressed by listening to John talk about what's really going on, but in fact I wasn't depressed at all. Now that I understand that these guys are inventing my world, because I understand how they're inventing my world, you know, how they create the matrix, how they get me to believe in a fake reality. Once I understand that, what I realize is I have the power to create my own world. If they can invent a world for me, I can invent my own world. I don't need them. I can invent my own world, which is exactly right. And it was a very, it was one of those interviews that really helps you realize the power you have to invent your own world, and I recommend it to you. The other was Jim Norman, back for the fourth time. Our discussion was the U.S. plays the oil card. I had one wonderful subscriber write in and say, please, won't you have somebody on to present the peak oil case? And I might do that at some point. But I think it is important to understand that new fracking technology, like it or not, has dramatically expanded the domestic reserves of oil and gas. We now have enough gas, if we had a converted infrastructure, for the U.S. to run for 100 years. And the impact that this is going to have on U.S. manufacturing is dramatic, because 40% of the cost to U.S. manufacturers is energy. That was a statistic I didn't know until Jim was on. And I think this is a very deep, very powerful trend. It's going to have a lot of impact on the North American strategic position. It could have a lot of impact on the value of the U.S. dollar. And it's another sort of sign in the pattern recognition that says to me that the bailout money is coming in and buying out. And so if that money is coming in and building manufacturing capacity, buying farmland, buying oil and gas leases, picking up big strategic real estate positions in places like Detroit, once that is all aggregated and ready to go, bringing down the oil and gas price on a long-life basis, very much relative to Asia and Europe, is tremendous. At the time of the interview, Jim pointed out that if oil had been trading on a BTU equivalent to the price of gas, it would be $11.65 a barrel. He pointed out that the price of natural gas is a multiple of seven times in Europe and a multiple of 15 times in Asia. That's an incredible competitive advantage, and it's just the kind of thing that can help keep the slow burn going for a long, long time. Unanswered questions of 2012. I started the year and I said, who's really in charge? I did an interview with the Daily Bell. That's still the big question. It's an even bigger question now after watching what Hollywood has done in the first half of the year. I mentioned this in the blog post. I've seen more alien invasions cinematically this year than ever before. I've watched Aliens and Cowboys, The Avengers, Men in Black 3, which is a kind of amusing movie. I love Will Smith, as everybody who knows me knows. And a very, very disappointing, I love Tony and Ridley Scott. I love everything they do. Ridley Scott came out with Prometheus, another alien invasion, which I thought was absolutely dreadful. It was kind of a prequel to Alien, which was a very famous movie he did. You know, but you kind of sit back and you look at all of these bizarre invasions by aliens and you think, what in the world is Hollywood trying to tell us? And I've always been concerned that that the leadership, once the war on terror turned out to be, you know, sort of not believable, that they would come up with, you know, alien invasion. I once said to George Norrie on Coast to Coast, he said, don't you think they're stealing all this money to deal with the aliens? I said, no, George, I just think they're stealing it, and they're saying, mommy, mommy, the aliens made me do it. But I think the extensiveness of the amount of money that Hollywood has spent trying to get us to think about alien invasions is something worth thinking about. And we've created a section called Wild Cards on the blog, and I've started to post what I think are the best videos in serious videos asking that question. Also, when mainstream media brings something up on that question, I'm tending to put it in there now just because I'm so deeply suspicious of how this might be used. My predictions for 2012, I said that at the beginning of the year, I said that war with Iran was 85% chance. I'm dropping that to 40% chance. I don't think it's going to happen this year. I think it'll be 2013 or 14. As I said before, I think the chances of a nuclear event are still high. I give that 75%. Doesn't mean it'll be World War III. It could be a, you know, a suitcase nuke. But I think we have, the danger is not that we have collapse. The danger is that we have war. The beginning of the year, I gave Obama a 65% chance against Romney. I'm shifting that now to 50-50. The one big change, the Bohemian Grove is going on now as we speak. It'll be interesting to see what we see coming out of the Grove. Romney has some absolutely dreadful handicaps publicly in this environment because of his record at Bain, and the Obama campaign seems to be using those very well and cleverly. We have a couple of billionaires saying they're going to spend nearly an infinite amount of money getting Romney elected, and all I can tell you is I think that will be, you know, part of QE3, is the amount of money spent on the Romney campaign. So let's see if we get any signal coming out of the Grove. We ought to know by early September. The one thing is if there is real support coming out of the Grove for Romney, I think it's bad news for the stock market because there's no way you get Romney elected without having very bad financial markets in the fall. My heroes this for the first half of the year are Joe Cross and Annette Larkin. Joe Cross, and I would add Phil Staples. Joe Cross is the Australian who made Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. Annette Larkin is a fabulous woman down in Miami who, and the video is up on the blog, has promoted juicing and eating fresh raw food, grows a lot of her own food in a very, very big backyard. And Joe Cross, Annette Larkin, and Phil Staples have done more to get Americans juicing than anybody I know. In fact, I got Franklin Sanders, I got him to promise me last week that he would watch Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And I called him this morning, and his wife said, oh, his hands are full, he's juicing, and he's been juicing for the last 4 days, which is the 4 days subsequent to watching Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. So I'm a great believer that the health plan we need in this country is one on a just-do-it method. So I think Joe Cross and Phil Staples and Annette Larkin have mapped out a health plan that could really do the trick. So check out, if you haven't seen Fat, Sick, or Nearly Dead, it's up on the internet for free. You can do a search for Annette Larkin and just find her there. Okay, well, that wraps it up for our wrap-up, except for the equity overview. Let me go very quickly through that. I want to talk about the equity markets a lot more on the Solari report. One, because I feel that the real wealth creation over the next 10 to 20 years will be in the equity area. Now, some of that will be in people starting their own companies or in venture capital, what's called private equity, or in private real estate. But some of it's going to be in the publicly traded markets. Now, it's going to be a tricky time because we're going to have so much volatility, particularly as we work through the debt issues and the reengineering of the economy and looking for a new economic model if the employment model is not going to stay dominant. So if you look at the changes we have to go through, they mean a lot of volatility, a lot of money can be made, but a lot of money can be lost. So I don't mean to underestimate the problems in the financial markets. What I do think is important to understand is if you look at the equity markets, there is no such thing as the stock market. The stock market is all publicly traded enterprises in all industries in all places. That's a very, very big combination of things. And if you look inside the stock market, what you see is that there are industries that are being born and there are industries that are dying. And there are industries in a primary trend down and there are industries in a primary trend up. And there are three areas that are in the primary trend up that are of great interest to me. And they're very, very simple and they're very, very long-lived. The first is emerging markets. We have a world that is rebalancing economically, and we have places with young populations that are growing and growing very dynamically. And that growth is going to go on for a long, long time. And if you look at the growth rates of a country like China or a country like Brazil against Europe and the United States, you know, and you map that out for 50 years, it's very clear how that rebalancing is going to happen. So one is the emerging markets. The second is natural resources. There's no way you can have more and more people on a planet with a fixed amount of natural resources and not have to take better care of our natural resources than we do, whether it's water, whether it's land, whether it's precious metals. And so there's a real change coming in how we manage, value, take care of precious metals, and I'm particularly interested not so much in the companies that own them, but the companies that have tremendous intellectual capital in managing and doing things with natural resources that are smarter and wiser, particularly doing things like turning waste into something useful. The third thing is technology. Technology is the thing we use to make the natural resources go further for the people and to make things better overall. Although, again, I understand that technology is a double-edged sword. But these are the primary trends where I see long-term opportunity. And yes, it's going to be tricky to figure out how and where to do it, given the volatility and given the politics and given the dangers of the transition that we're in. Yet at the same time, if we are going to adjust and if we're going to change, then it's going to be enterprises that help us figure out how to implement those changes and do it in a way that's very innovative in terms of preserving and caring for our natural resources. And so to me, that's where the big opportunity is, and it's one that not only do I not want to walk away from, but I want to go and dive right into it. And it's one I spend a lot of time every day trying to figure out and intend to do so for the next two decades. So I have asked my partner at Sealy and Chuck Gibson to join me in doing a quarterly equity overview on the Sealy Report, and I think you'll start to see more and more guests that I'll ask who will inform those three primary trends. And if there are anything in those areas that you would be interested in hearing about, please let me know, and I will make every effort to do so. So that's going to be the framework for the equity markets, and expect to hear and see more from us coming out over the next 6 months. Let's go to the movie. Our movie this week was The Incurables. It wasn't Incurables. Intouchables. In fact, I had one of the subscribers write me and say, "You made a mistake on the blog. You misspelled Untouchables." I said, no, it's really supposed to be that. It's Intouchables. The Intouchables is a movie that came out in France in 2011. It quickly shot up, I think, in 6 weeks to become the second most viewed movie in France. It's a feel-good dramatic comedy. It's the story of a very wealthy man who's had a terrible accident and is now basically paralyzed from the neck down. And he needs a caretaker. He hires a tall, handsome, smart black guy from the streets, from the projects, and they become fast friends. And it's the story of the transformation that they bring to each other's life. And it's quite amusing, quite funny, and it brings you back to the power of an intimate human friendship and the extraordinary things that it can do. And it had me laughing for days. I still laugh thinking about it. The trailer is up on the blog. The Intouchables, you can take kids to it, you can take family to it. It's almost PG, and it's a lovely, lovely movie. Yes, it's in French and with subtitles, but it's so great, and the acting is so great that I'm sure it won't bother you, even if you hate subtitles. So Intouchables, I recommend it. Check it out. so that's it for our wrap-up. Coming up, we have next week. I'm very excited. John Rappaport has agreed to do record a special audio for the Solari Report once a month. We'll be posting it in the last week of the month. This week, or next week, it's going to be Inside the Medical Matrix. We'll post it on Thursday. It will not be live, so don't dial in. It will be posted on the blog. The following week, August 2nd, we've had so much news on Penn State and from the Vatican on the pedophilia issues, I thought it was time to finally sit down and have a serious discussion of what's going on with pedophilia, why it's so important, control files, how it relates to control files, personnel benefits, and politics. So we're calling it Pedophilia and Politics. And I've invited Nick Bryan, who's an author of a new book out from Tryon Press on the Franklin cover-up, a very famous expose of a pedophilia network. In fact, that touched my life personally when I was assistant secretary, and I'll tell you the story about it. So Pedophilia and Politics with Nick Bryan on August 2nd, and then we'll be back with Franklin Sanders on Precious Metals the following week, August 9th. And don't forget, we've launched the website transformationgathering.com for the Transformations and Renewals Conference that's coming up in October 12th to 14th. You can check out, once you log into the Solari Report, you can check out the ad and link from the ad on the Solari blog. We're only telling subscribers about it for the first 2 weeks, both for the Money Changer and Solari, because it's we're only allowing 50 registrants. We want to keep it very small and intimate, so we want to make sure that our subscribers have the first crack at signing up. But after 2 weeks, then we'll let it go broadly. We'll market it to our full email list for both companies. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until I talk to you on August 2nd with Nick Bryan, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. There is definitely a conspiracy, but don't worry about whether there is one. If you're not in one, you need to start one. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.